Modern and traditional awards that many wine aficionados, students or professionals have heard of. But what about postmodernism? In this podcast, Clark Smith, the author of Postmodern Winemaking, touches upon how modern winemaking changed the wine industry. For modern winemaking is generally referred as wines that have developed after the Second World War, when electricity had become widely available. Clark has a deep knowledge of winemaking and its science. His book explores what modern techniques can add to the tool of a winemaker and how to best utilize them. For him, postmodern winemakers are those who make wine in their own vision. We talk about the changes in modern wines, in particular for white wine, the influence of oxygen in winemaking, and the principles of microoxygenation. Clark's challenge consumers to speak to winemakers and to get to know them. On a personal level, I know there are many winemaking techniques and instruments that may be used in winemaking, and regardless of their controversy, they are worth exploring and understanding as they play a part in the final product that we much enjoy. Also, for those who are pursuing higher levels of wine education, winemaking covers a big part of the examination. Hi, I'm Mattia Scarpazza, and this is the Looking Into Wine podcast. Wine and winemaking can be complex, but this podcast has a simple mission. We want to give you the skills and tools to harness your passion about wine. Through this series, we will shine a spotlight on some of the different regions, processes, and concepts that shape the fascinating world of wine. I hope you enjoy the show and your own journey, Looking Into Wine. Welcome to Looking Into Wine. Today's guest is Clark Smith, author of Postmodern Winemaking. Welcome to the podcast, Clark.
Thank you, Mattia. It's a great privilege.
So, Clark, why, you have a long history on winemaking and in this department. Why did you decide to write the book, and how is the book structured?
Yes. Well, to begin with, I've been in 60 vintages now. 45 in the Northern Hemisphere and 14 in the Southern Hemisphere and one on the East Coast. I went to Davis. I got a couple of degrees there. And I began writing it as a kind of a note to other winemakers about all of the things they taught us in school that aren't really true. For example, wine is treated like it's a chemical solution, and it's not. Its structure is very important. So it's much more like a sauce, like a Bernays sauce or a chocolate sauce or something. And the properties of the, you know, the suspended gouge in a Bernays sauce, you know, the little butter beads, have a lot to do with the way the wine tastes. So its composition isn't as important as the way things are put together. So I started off in a fairly geeky conversation about that and about the tools that I've been taught to work with. You know, more and more as I began to speak about these things starting in about 2000, I started getting attacked that winemakers aren't supposed to do anything, that the best wine is made through benign neglect. And that's just not true. In the meantime, winemakers are terrified of these people. And so if they're asked what they do, they say, well, I really do the minimum, or I don't do anything. And all of them are working all the time as hard as they can, 24/7, to make better wine. And there's no money in it. You know, it's really, to be a winemaker, they say you should never be a jazz musician unless you have to. And winemakers are the same way. The only reason to do it is for the love of it. But to me, being a winemaker is a higher calling. And we shouldn't lie to people about what we do because our honor is all we have. So in the 90s, I invented some techniques using reverse osmosis. My problem is I had studied in France, and the French would come over and they'd say, well, these grapes aren't ripe. You need to give them more hang time. And I realized that the reason that that's true in California is that our air is too dry. So water evaporates from the grapes, and that means they have a too high of a sugar content when the flavors are properly developed. And so I figured out a way to use reverse osmosis filtration and distillation to take alcohol out of the wine and take it back down to a proper balance point so that we could make Eurocentric style wines in California.
So how is the book structured?
Well, that's what attracted people to think that, you know, because I was willing to talk about these things, they started calling me Dr. Evil. All right, so the advantage here was that I was already famously evil. And that meant that I could tell the truth, and it wouldn't make any difference because I had nothing to lose. All right, so that's, you know, I feel that there's a really, the relationship today between winemakers and wine lovers has all the aspects of a bad marriage, where nobody's telling the truth, and there are all these suspicions, and they just don't understand each other. And because of the natural wine movement and this whole idea that wine shouldn't be manipulated, winemakers are afraid to talk about their work. So that's why I wrote the book, was to create a conversation about the things that I've come to believe that are different from what I was taught in school, but also to allow wine lovers that, you know, it could be a master of wine or just a, you know, person, a general consumer, to let them look over our shoulder, be a fly on the wall, to the kinds of conversations that we actually have, and just to get a feel for it. All right, so the book, the first 11 chapters, and this may have been a mistake, are highly technical. I just don't feel like, without discussing some chemistry and some technical things, I don't think it's possible to have a philosophical conversation. And so I would say, if you're not a winemaker, you're going to have a hard time with the first half of the book. You really should start with Appendix 1, which is how wine is made. It's about 7 pages. And then the introduction is about what postmodernism is and what does it have to do with winemaking. The 12th chapter is called Winemaking's Lunatic Heroes. And it's about science. You know, the scientific method is not a formula for discovery. It's just a clerical process that comes along. It's not the engine of progress. It's the caboose. It's not a method for discovering new stuff. That happens with crazy people that try things. Most of the time they fail. But when they succeed, you have like Robert Mondavi. Everybody thought he was crazy to plant Cabernet way down in the frozen tundra of Oakville, you know? And then you have Constantin Franck putting Riesling in the Finger Lakes. What an insane idea. But it turned out to be the best Riesling in the country. And anyway, so I go through some of these giants that just got lucky, really. And then everybody else followed them. So that's the way winemaking really progresses, right? And just what their world is like. And then we have, I guess it's 4 chapters on the new technologies and the new filtrations. Talk a little about a new winemaking procedure called flash detente. And just, you know, kind of taking off our technological clothes. And then the last part of the book is philosophy. So, for example, I think it's reprehensible to take a 200-year-old French oak tree, cut it up, make a piece of fine oak furniture out of it, and just use it to flavor the wine. And then after 3 years, you cut it up and use it to plant vegetables in. It's just awful. So I want my barrels to outlive me. I like them better when they're neutral. And then if I want flavor, I'll get it from roasted chips, sort of like coffee beans that are roasted to different temperatures. And that's 75% of that tree has been wasted and thrown away. And now, you know, we can be much more environmentally conscious. So you can see how if you're an environmentalist, that you'd like that. If you're a traditionalist, or you just don't like this manipulation thing, then you'd be very much against it.
Absolutely. And I think one of the key points at the beginning of the book, it was all the concept of after the Second World War, how winemaking changed and how everything changed and everything became modern and how now it's becoming postmodern. What did change? What was for you the biggest changes?
Well, people don't realize it, but today's modern white wines didn't exist before the bomb. They're products of atomic energy. Before World War II, the only way you got sweet wine was either port and sherry, which is microbially stable because it has so much alcohol that it kills anything that tries to grow on it. It used to be that all champagne was extremely sweet, and that was really the only sweet table wine. The sec is 6% sugar. That's twice as much sugar as a white Zinfandel. And Botrytis wines, which, of course, were very rare and expensive. So there really wasn't anything. And the wines weren't fresh. They were aged and profound. Just you know, like a white Burgundy would be just as profound as a red Burgundy. You might age it for 10 years before you release it. Well, that's today. The prime directive is for white wine to be fresh. And what changed everything was Blue Nun. Peter Sechel invented the idea of Liebfrau milk, off dry, it made in a new way, fresh, fruity, low alcohol, a little bit of sugar. Yummy. Totally delicious. Nobody had ever tasted a wine like that before. And so it just swept across the planet and replaced, well, California is an example. In California in 1960, the average alcohol of a California wine was 18.5 because it was 95% port and sherry. By 1970, that was only 5%, and the average alcohol was 11% because all the wine we were making was Blue Nun knockoffs, Winnie Gray Riesling and Weibel Green Hungarian and Gallo Chablis and Rhine wine, Dry Sauternes, which was sweet. And so now we're still in that framework. What's changing is we're starting to pay a little tiny bit of attention to the Georgian Quevery wines, which are really the way all white wine was for the first 8,000 years.
Absolutely. I mean, and also you were saying in the book there was a lot of interest of postmodernism is about the oxygen and the use of oxygen and how that environmentally free oxygen, that it was sort of a new thing and people are going back to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, like I said, winemaking is just a form of cooking. It's the ultimate slow food, if you like, because it takes years to make, to make a wine. So we were taught in school that oxygen is the enemy of wine, that we want our wines to be fresh. We don't want them to be oxidized. And that's resulted in a lot of really bad red wine. Because oxygen is like a stove. And if you don't know what you're doing, of course you can burn food with the stove. But that doesn't mean the stove is bad. It means you need some education. You need some training to use a stove, and that's how you become a chef. So to me, oxygen is it's the wire whisk when you're making a tannin souffle. So when you make a souffle, you separate the egg yolk from the white, and then you take the whisk and you make a meringue, and then you have a rich, light structure. Then you fold the fatty yolks back in and put it in the oven. So we do exactly the same thing. Instead of the yolks, we have the lees, the yeast lees. And so we can't really, they will consume the oxygen, so we have to let them at least sit on the bottom of the tank or rack off, so we have clear wine. And it has all this tannin, and it's very green. It's harsh and right up in the front of the mouth, and we bring in oxygen, and we create this rich, light structure. If you don't do that, then the green tannin will curdle and become dry and sort of dirty, and the wines will fall apart, and they won't have these integrative flavor properties that a good structure can give you. So there's several chapters in the book that are talking about the technique of trying to teach somebody how to make a tannin soufflé.
One of the techniques, it was the microcisionation, and you go through all the different stages, so when and where, how would that change? Just what is this microcisionation for someone?
Well, the whole idea, just like with the stove, you don't want to bring so much heat that you burn the food. So you need to adjust the flame. In the same way, we want to bring in oxygen slower than the wine is able to consume it and create structure. If you go too fast, then everything falls apart. Just like when you're making a souffle, if you heat it too much, then it falls. So wines have incredible appetite for oxygen. Red wines, when they first are finished fermentation, they can take, sometimes the Cabernet will take 100 times what a barrel can give it. After we get our malolactic and we add SO2, that drops by about an order of magnitude. And then after the wine is aged, it drops again, by an order of magnitude, and then when it ages, it drops another order of magnitude. So we have a 10,000-fold difference in the same wine, just at the stage of its age. It's just like people. The Chinese talk about when you're young, you need to exchange your qi with the universe. And when you're old, you have to guard your qi. And that's how Randall Graham talks about micro-ox.
Absolutely. I mean, it's all very interesting when you read in the book, there's all these scientific points, which obviously whoever wants to read it, it's all there, and you can have all the numbers and figures to go through. And who is a postmodern winemaker? What is an example of a postmodern winemaker? What they do differently?
Well, how can I say this? Modern winemaking is represented by what you see on the grocery store shelf. And it's all million case wineries, and they're trying to make a consistent product. So you get, in Europe, the consistency comes from the appellation. So everybody knows what a Beaujolais is like, or a Chianti, or I like to say Chateau Latour is a terrible Beaujolais. So there are a lot of maybe 600 or so well-known appellations, Muscadet Sur Lee, we know what those are. In the United States, what's on the shelf, there's only about 20. And really, it's the big four, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Pinot, a little bit of Merlot, a little bit of Zinfandel, and, that's it. Then you have Chardonnay, Riesling, Pinot Grigio, very small number of categories. And you might have 50 Merlots on the shelf there at Safeway, but they all taste the same. So that's modern winemaking. That's standardized modern winemaking. It's just like the music business. When in the AM dial, you have Capitol Records, you have Britney Spears and Shania Twain and about 1,000 other bands that are owned by Capitol Records. And they take over the whole dial and that's it. But then you have millions of garage bands and barbershop quartets and church choirs. Each of them has their own little statement, their sound. And it's different from any other sound. So postmodern winemaking doesn't go off in one direction. It goes off in 10,000 directions. And the great part about it is that you can actually go visit these people, just like in Europe. You know, if you're in a little town, you find a winery that they only sell wine within a kilometer of the winery. That's their whole market. It's been that way for 100 years. And you can go and you can meet the guy and you can pet his dog and, you know, and this is the same way. It's a very personal contact where you're exploring and learning what that particular person's vision is.
So the postmodern, would you say, is more on the new world compared to the old world, like Europe, for instance? So would you say there's more like this movement of people going out of?
Well, in my case, I like to make Eurocentric wines. I like to make forgeries. My Napa Chardonnay is called Faux Chablis. And it's a lot like a Chablis, and it takes 15 years to come around in the bottle. 2005 is my current vintage, and the 06 isn't ready yet. But that's my personal exploration. But that's just me. That's just one idea. I think in Barolo, they talk about postmodern winemaking there. And what they mean is to get away from the long hang time that makes the wines dry out early on. They want to go back to the old way of making Barolo, where the wines, they're terrible for the first 10 years. You have to hold them, but then they age forever. And so that's their idea of going back away from the modern. But you can go forward too, or you can go sideways.
Okay, well, it's all the people that they're losing their old ways to create something unique, and I think is very important. And there's a lot of them, and what makes wine interesting in the end of the day.
Right. If you compare it with I mean, how many spirits are there really? Maybe, there must be 200 scotches and 100 rums, and it really isn't that hard to taste pretty much all the spirits in the world. You know, maybe it's a couple thousand, where for us, it's more like millions of different wines. You can never scratch the surface. And so it's absolutely critical that we all disagree. We all have our own way of doing things. I organize postmodern symposia where we talk to each other about what we do. But the first thing we say is, okay, let's not agree about anything, because if we all made wine the same way, it would be like the dairy business, you know, where you're all just trying to deliver milk and it all tastes the same.
Okay, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it was one of the quotes on the book. It was about the a famous wine buyer or for a big chain in the USA, and how she was saying that if it's interesting, that wine fails. And obviously,
that's right.
For me, it was quite an interesting point to think about, and it's quite different.
Yeah, that's the buyer for Costco. She recently retired, but she's famous for saying that wine is toilet paper.
What is for you like the biggest changes, or what? How do you see the technological part of the last 30 to 40 years impacting the new winemakers and doing something different? Do they, what do you think is they wanted, or is it not, or something?
Well, we have more tools now than we used to have. It doesn't mean we need to use them. I think, you know, just like a marriage, you know, there's a lot of love there, always, even when things aren't going well. And I think what we have in common, especially for people that are interested in the small guys, if they just want a beverage, you know, so that they can get a little bit high, that and that's probably most people. But there's still something more sacred about wine than beer and spirits and other. That I don't even think my wines are particularly good beverages. I'm going for profundity. It's just kind of like a really great Cuban cigar. It tastes terrible. It's just awful. But it has profundity. And that's what I strive for. And for people that have an appreciation of that or can gain it just from tasting a wine and having it show you a place in your soul that you didn't know you had. That's the reason that I do what I do. And I think that's true of almost all winemakers. They want to touch your soul. Just like a jazz musician. That's what they're in it for. And they sacrifice a lot to do that. So what I hope your listeners will take from this is that they should be just like how you heal a bad marriage. You have to listen. You have to communicate that you're open to hearing the truth. And it's fun. I mean, you know, the chefs are doing it. Wolfgang Puckett's on TV and he says, "Well, I got this ripe Brie and I want to grate it so I can put it in my puff machine, but it's too gooey, so I'm going to freeze it with liquid nitrogen. You want to watch?" And so he's just having a ball with these new techniques. And that, you know, that can be the kind of conversation you have with your local winemaker. If you just let them know that you're okay hearing their real dream.
Okay. Well, yes, absolutely. And I think there is a lot of these things that then unfortunately they don't get talked a lot, or they don't get spoken about, because they're becoming almost a dogma in the wine business, and people, they don't want to consumer, they don't want to hear, but I think it's, they're there and they exist, and why not to speak about them? And then whether you agree on the use or not is all personal, but they exist and they should be talked about.
It's a lot more fun.
Absolutely. Well, Clark, I think our time is starting running low. I wanted just to, before I let you go, I was...
I did want to talk a little bit about the last chapter, which is about wine and music. I think wine actually is liquid music. It carries human emotion. And that chapter is basically about how you can, by picking the right music to go with the wine, you can enhance the experience of every wine you drink for the rest of your life.
I mean, we're going to do an episode at some point about this topic, and it will be very interesting to hear all this topics, how do you pair and everything. And where people can find you, I know you have a website. And
yes, it's called whoisclarksmith.com. And then we have a wine shop, but unfortunately everything is just being sold in the U.S.
For the U.S. consumers.
Okay. Yeah. We're pretty small.
Imagine. Okay, perfect. Thank you for this half an hour today, and thank you for clarifying and helping me with some of the topics and everything. And I hope we will have another conversation at some point about the more scientific or more technical points in the future. I think it will be very interesting, and I'm sure I gather some good feedbacks about them, and I can ask my listeners if they like to to learn about this?
Oh, I'd be very interested to how, you know, what people make of this, this crazy book. I can't thank you enough for giving me a pulpit to speak from.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you so much again. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode. As I said at the beginning, I think that winemaking is an important factor for the final wine. And I aim over the season to bring more content related to winemaking and wine science. I would love to hear from you on social media what you think about it. Or you can leave a comment at the bottom of the podcast. You joined the conversation today with Clark Smith on Looking Into Wine, author of Postmodern Winemaking. As always, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. Remember, if you subscribe, you are notified about all the latest episodes that are coming up. And please feel free to share with your friends so they can learn and discover about the world of wine. You can also find the podcast on mattiascarpazza.com, where you can also donate for the success of the podcast and the project. A special thanks to today's guest again to Clark Smith. Music produced by Samuele Di Nardo. Editing and mastering by Tommaso Ascoli.